Right. Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out. I know we discussed last week that as the holidays are coming up, as Purim's coming up, as Pesach is coming up, it'd be a good opportunity to try to prepare for those holidays. The holidays I find, are always meaningful whenever you go to hear the Megillah or sit down at your Pesach Seder. It's always meaningful. It always brings back memories. But when you go into the holiday, having prepared a little bit, having learned a little bit about the holiday, the themes of the holiday, hopefully that will be able to enhance our enjoyment of the holidays. So I thought leading up to it, we have two times before Purim and a couple times afterwards before Pesach. So maybe we can look at some a little bit of Torah related to those holidays. So tonight I want to focus on an aspect of the Megillah that I think many of us are familiar with the idea that the Megillah is the story of Purim is characterized by hiddenness, right? The name of Hashem is not mentioned in the Megillah, and if you just read the story, and I wonder if you just read the story without necessarily in a religious lens, would you even see God? Would that be apparent that God was orchestrating events? Clearly we know that Hashem was in control of events, but why is it then? It's kind of curious. Why would Hashem? Well, I say why does Hashem? The Gemara says that Esther and Mordechai wrote with Ruach HaKodesh, they wrote Megillas Esther. So why would they leave out Hashem? Right? It almost seems like you're making a, they obviously recognize that Hashem was involved. Why would they leave him out?
I didn't follow. Why
There's a
would
stu Sorry.
who leave him out?
So the Mordechai and Esther, who wrote the book of Esther. So why would they, they're writing a book about their experiences, about their salvation. Why would they leave God out? Yes, Moshe.
I would simply propound a very simple answer that it was known from the very beginning. I don't mean by Ruach HaKodesh, but it was understood from the very beginning from Mordechai's contacts in the court that this was going to have to be a joint effort. That is to say that whatever was written was going to have to be palatable to the rabbinate, but also palatable to the to the empire. And
Though it didn't portray the
the empire,
empire
the
particularly
sorry?
positively.
Pardon?
It doesn't portray the empire particularly positively.
Well, I think that all depends on your perspective.
It
I
could
mean,
be,
if
yeah.
I think if you follow, I mean, from my perspective, and I'm not trying to prove it to anybody, Ahasuerus is a genius. The only person smarter than him is Esther. Haman is a fool, but Ahasuerus is a very, very cunning, smart person. I mean, he didn't get his empire for no reason, and he's a very, very smart person. The
Right, he didn't
rabbis,
marry into
unfortunately,
royalty, but that's a very interesting perspective.
the rabbis unfortunately hate him, and since they hate him, therefore they're biased in the picture that they're portrayed.
But obviously,
So,
they
I'm
had
not.
a right. They had a tradition, or they understood in the story that he was not such an upstanding individual. But it could be that he had a certain prowess.
Rabbi, can I
Yes.
just add another thought? How does a religious man like Mordechai agree to send his niece to a beauty contest?
If you understand the story through how our sages understood it, through the Gemara and Megillah, so it, we tell we so often sometimes present it as a beauty contest, but it was really after Vashti was deposed, Ahasuerus ordered that all of the women in all the provinces come, and he'd basically rape them all and pick the one that. They would stay in the ones who he didn't want would stay in the harem, and he would. The idea was he would pick one for her wife, and they were taken by force. In fact, it's understood that Esther tried to try to avoid being taken as long as possible. So I think that that's what was going on. They were actually, women were taken by force.
Yes. But she was making herself ugly so that he wouldn't.
Right. She didn't make efforts to adorn herself. So there's the Megillah is characterized by hiddenness, and its authors really intentionally wrote it that way.
I didn't know that Esther and Mordechai wrote it though. That's the first time I heard that.
Right. Chazal say that. That's a tradition really have that they wrote it. So it must be that we're meant to learn something from the fact that God isn't mentioned. I don't think what the lesson is that God isn't present in our lives. And I think if anything, we're meant to learn something from the fact that God is not mentioned in the Megillah, but about God, about our service of God. And I want to explore a little bit about what those lessons could be.
Sounds like an interesting approach.
Okay, so stay along for the ride.
Well, it's so, kind of like a precursor to what's to come, right? Because he's hidden now too.
Right.
But we know he runs the world.
Right. It very much mirrors, I think, our lives more than some other parts of Tanakh. I think that's a very good point. But so the Gemara asks in Cholin, where can you find Esther min haTorah minayin? Where in the Torah can one find an allusion to the events involving Esther? So you could say, first, what do you mean? Then Esther is not in the Torah, right? It's in the Ksuvim, in the writings. So I actually have the source sheet up here, but if I were to ask you, would there be any place in the Torah where we would find an allusion to the events of Esther?
So Yom Kippur,
right? So that's probably a later, more mystical idea that it's, or a Hasidic idea that Yom Kippur, that there's opportunities for spirituality on Purim that may even in some respects be greater than on Yom Kippur. But I don't know if that's the allusion in the Torah. So actually,
it isn't Yom Kippur, because we know perfectly well it's about God judging us. That's not hidden.
Right. Yom Kippur isn't, right. There, if anything, there's more of a revelation on Yom Kippur than any other day of the year. So where in the Torah does it give an allusion to Esther? So the Gemara says that it's in a pasuk towards the end of the Torah, right after Moshe gives his farewell address and an admonition to the people. And Hashem calls him up to tell him that time has come to leave the world. And in that process, Hashem tells Moshe really what the future, unfortunately, of the Jewish people holds, at least at certain periods in their existence. And he says, V'anochi hastir astir ponai b'yom ahu, I will surely hide my face on that day. And I copy a larger portion of the passage in Devarim, in source number 2. He tells Moshe that he's about to lie with his forefathers. And he says to Moshe, "Become amazeh, and the nation will come. Achrei Elohei nechar ha'aretz, after foreign gods of land, asher hu bashama bikribo." They'll follow to be influenced by the gods in Eretz Yisrael, meaning, but the gods of the nations who live there. Vazavani ve'ther esprisi, that they'll forsake me and violate my covenant, asher karati ito, that I forged with them. V'chara api bo bayomahu, and my wrath will rage against them on that day. Vazavtim, then I will abandon them, and I'll hide my face from them, and then they'll be vulnerable to their enemies. And then when they're in this terrible situation, and the people will say, the Jewish people will say, "Valo al ki ein elokai b'kirbi mitzauni haroz ha'ila, are all of these troubles coming upon me because Hashem isn't in my midst? Meaning they'll think that Hashem has abandoned them. You have this idea of hiddenness. And then it quotes what the Gemara in source number one had said is the source in the Torah, the allusion, the place in the Torah where the story of Esther is alluded to, Vanochi astir panai biyom hahu, and I will surely hide my face on that day, kol hara asher asah, and because all the evil they've committed, kivana Elohim achirim, and they turn to other gods. So it sounds like the events of Esther come at a low point in the history of the Jewish people, right? It sounds like if we're saying that the allusion to Esther in the Torah is that when Hashem says, I will surely hide my face. So it says, when does Hashem do it? At a time when the Jewish people had forsaken their covenant with Hashem, were worshiping other things, involved in other things. And I think we do see this, at least what we know from the Talmud and from our sages about the Jews' behavior within the Persian society, that they went to the feast of Ahasuerus, they were involved in things that Mordechai and the other sages told them they shouldn't be. So it seems like at a time when this was during also their exile from the after the destruction of the first base of Mikdash. So it was not at a high point. And the Talmud says in source number one that statement, I will hide my face, is the allusion in the Torah to the events of Megillas Esther.
The problem with that is that he did not consume them, and no evil befell them.
So we see the in the end, there was the Nahahu, that everything was turned around, but at least that was the stage that was set at the beginning.
To me, it sounds more like it applies to the period of the Nevi'im, when they really were punished and they really evil did befall them.
So maybe then God wasn't as hidden. Right, I think prophecy was more, there was still some prophecy, but basic prophecy, you had prophets, the people may have been at a lower point. Right, hard to say, but here, just in the book of Esther, there's God isn't described, and maybe reflects a certain distance at least that existed at the time. So at the same time, we know that at the end of the story. Hashem had completely turned around events. The people were sason v'simcha. They were jubilant. They were joyful. There was a total turnaround from negative to positive. So, and it's clear that the way we understand it, it's clear that Hashem is involved. That Hashem orchestrated this turnaround from the entire nation being condemned to destruction to the to really a victory over their enemies. And well, not everything was great after. We're still under the subjugation of Ahasuerus, but a complete turnaround as far as the decree.
Rabbi?
Yep.
Yeah, it was a turnaround as far as the decree, but it didn't indicate whether the Jewish people were looking to God even more.
But we see in the Megillah that the people fasted for 3 days and estimating that's reflective of prayer and tshuva. You know, that's the way it's understood that the salvation happened because the people did tshuva. And they cried out to Hashem.
Okay.
So I think there was a turnaround in their behavior. But so the question is, after all of this, after this turnaround from sorrow to joy, why don't we mention Hashem? What are we meant to learn from the fact that Hashem isn't mentioned? So I'll just ask a question. and there may not be, certainly there's no right or wrong answer, and there may not be one or the other, but which would you say is preferable as far as just in the world we live, to have Hashem more concealed or Hashem more revealed?
I like Rhonda's answer. It presages the times that we live in when we know there's a God, but he's not involved in the sense that he was with Moshe Rabbeinu or with the Nevi'im.
Right. So is that an advantage or a disadvantage?
I would have said an advantage, a disadvantage, except that the behavior of our people was not any better when they had the Nevi'im. So I'm not sure it's either one.
Right. Maybe now we can, at least not be held as accountable, because we, but it shows that, you always say, oh, if only it was so clear, if only I was at Har Sinai, the Shamas were all at Har Sinai. Well, look what happened right after Har Sinai. If only there were Nevi'im. Well, look what happened when the people had Nevi'im. Meaning there's no magic solution. If we don't act the way we're supposed to act, so it's not going to help us. So that's certainly the case, meaning we shouldn't be so sure that it would help us. But as you said, it would seem to be a disadvantage, the fact that we would, we want, and hopefully we would rise to the task of having Hashem more manifest, to understand his ways, to understand why things happen, and to have a more clear relationship between us and him. Seemingly that would be better. And truth is, we have Rav Shimshon David Pinkus. Brother Kids was killed in a car accident a couple of years ago, relatively young age. But he was a great writer and speaker. So he really explains, what does each manifestation of God, whether it's more hidden or more revealed, what does that give us? What are we supposed to take away from that? They say that we earn more merit by finding Hashem when he's not obvious, right? So that could be a purpose, that there is maybe a source of merit, that we have the opportunity to, there's a greater degree of free will that we have, and maybe it is a source of merit. So Rav Pinkus says, he compares Purim to Pesach, right? If we think about all the events on our calendar, Purim is the most hidden, right? There's no mention of God. And what's the other extreme, right? Pesach, right? What could be more a holiday that celebrates, that mentions, and that's centered around Hashem's revelation in the world? Meaning it's sort of the opposite. The Haggadah doesn't mention Moshe. It says in Az Yashir, Moshe Abdo, it referenced to Moshe, but it doesn't, the Haggadah doesn't mention Moshe. The Haggadah doesn't mention Moshe. The Megillah doesn't mention Hashem. So these are the two extremes. Okay, then you have Hanukkah, you have the victory, you have the oil, but basically Pesach and Purim are the two extremes. So what are we meant to learn from each of them? Obviously, both of those are meant to teach us lessons, not just stories, meaning the stories could be told. It didn't have to have that contrast between being completely, quote unquote, God-centric and not mentioning Hashem. So what's the difference? So Rav Pinkus says in source number 3, Tzui Gama Siba Latak, this is also the reason, Shalom, Shalom Muzgar B'Kola Megillah, Avshem Mishemos Hashem Yisrach, that none of the names of God are mentioned in the Megillah. Kevach Imaya Kasu Ilay Shemo, if it would, his name would be written explicitly, Shalakadish Baraku, Haisa Zui Yitzia Migeder HaTeva L'mala Teva, then this would create a departure from the natural into the supernatural. That's what Pesach is for. Pesach is all about the supernatural. I mean, the supernatural and the natural are both from Hashem, but Pesach is about the supernatural. Once you mention Hashem in the context of the story, then you're framing it as far as the supernatural. Ach Purim megal lanu shekol davar betoch hateva. That it teaches us that each aspect within nature is imbued with the love of Hashem. Right? There's no difference between, no fundamental difference between Hashem's, our relationship with Hashem and his manifestation on Pesach and on Purim. And Purim is meant to emphasize that within nature and within, as we said, within the lives that we're familiar with, that Hashem is there and his love is present. So now Pinchas asks the question, maybe we'll ask before he provides his answer. Where do we find a more intense love? The type of love of Pesach or the type of love on Purim? So Pinchas says, they're different. Bechag Pesach, that in Pesach Hashem raised us over the entire world. He gives an elevated status. About the Purim, Anu, it's a Kaddish Baruch Hu, that in Purim we discover God. B'kol nekuda nekuda shel teva. It's more of our pursuit and our proactiveness on Purim. You know, Pesach is Hashem. He's taking us out. Purim involves us going to recognize Hashem in every aspect of life. So you could say in some ways that Purim has an advantage in that sense, that it's time for us to go and sharpen our perception of Hashem in the world and in our lives. And that's, I think, very relevant to some of the comments, like Gerald's comment, an opportunity to earn reward, meaning Purim is really for us. That's the called the avoda. That's our service on Purim. And we're given the opportunity to do that on Purim, really by presenting an extreme example of seemingly Hashem's non-involvement. He says, why is it called Purim? Right? It's called Purim because of Al Shem HaPur, because of the lot, right? They, did a lottery and he spinned the wheel and it fell on the gate in Adar. So, but it's L'chora, Ein Davar Tivi Yoser Migorel. What could be more random than a lottery, right? The whole thing is you're shaking it up. It's not even like I'm making choices or I'm. What could possibly be more random, more natural than a lottery? Shela Olam Itzep Hadav Echad Mitoch HaGoral. Because at the end of the day, one lot is always going to emerge. You know, there's a randomness, there's a predictability. You can't eat them. L'chora L'tavos L'tavon. Therefore, there's room to claim mistakenly that this lot only came out by chance. Right? You could say it was all by chance that the original execution date was another. It was all by chance that that Mordechai overheard Bigtan and Teresh and Nachashirosh had. I mean, you could say it's all by chance. And it's just like a lot, you know, the world goes on. Something's going to happen. Something's always going to come out. But you can mistakenly think that it only came about by chance. But there are many examples where the drawing of lots is in fact an expression of the work of God. We see that with the. One second. I'm just going to mute and everyone can unmute themselves. So, and we see the idea of a lot are drawn elsewhere. For example, when the land of Israel was divided among the tribes, so each tribe was demanding the land that it wanted. So lots were drawn, but don't think that those lots were random. Hashem wanted each tribe to have a different portion of the land of Israel. So you see, even the most random type of thing, like a lot, doesn't just yield results by happenstance, but even then, the point of Purim is to recognize that even in those lots, even those most random things, Hashem is there. Marcia?
Okay, you know, now I understand Donald Trump. Seriously, when he said that the election results were fake news, he thought it was supposed to be by lottery.
I was going to say,
I'm just kidding. I'm just being silly.
No, but I'll say this. I think based on what we've seen, he was correct that the election was rigged, right? But he was just wrong about who rigged it.
I wasn't being serious. Please don't.
No, but I think it's a good point. The election was rigged, right? The election was rigged. It just wasn't rigged by whatever. Okay, and that's an
political thing. It was a lot easier for Haman to rig the lottery than to rig the elections. Believe me.
So, but exactly that. And continuing it. On the original question, which reveals more closeness, this the type of holiday of Pesach or Purim? So he says in number five, the Chag Purim Megala Lanu, that the holiday of Purim reveals to us, lo rak as a Ava Hagdula she's Ora B'Shat HaSakana, not only the great love that's aroused at a time of danger, right? In Purim, they were in a dangerous situation, and then Hashem reversed. Then Ella, as kol mahus ha'olam, in every inner nature of the world, as masha kol echad sarik akshok kasher hu shows at kosmayim, and this is something that a person has to think about whenever we drink a cup of water, mevarek shakol niyeh bedvaro, that all comes about because of his work, right? Even the cup of water, that's the whole point. Everything is from Hashem. But Megillah Megala as and the Megillah, which is written without the name of God, reveals that the greatest closeness to God that is present in the world of nature. And the power of Purim is in nature itself. He says not just that Hashem brings us from Yagum to Simcha, from distress to happiness, but even when it's not that big salvation, that it's a cup of water, that it's anything in our lives, that's what Purim is supposed to inculcate within us, that appreciation and that understanding. So another angle to the question I posed of which is better, which is preferable. That's the right answer. Okay. It was Kamala in the Purim story. All right, lots of good. Okay, well, I'll have to, it's very much in the spirit of Purim. So there another aspect to the question of which is better, which is more meaningful, Hashem hidden or Hashem being revealed. So as I said at the outset, there's no right answer. And I don't even think it's a cop-out, but the answer is really both. Both have things to learn and both have their appropriate time. So Yitzhak Kuttner gives the following analogy. I think it's a wonderful way of bringing out this point. He said you have two people who are given the job of recognizing people at night, either detectives, whatever it is. So the first one used a flashlight so you could see the faces of the people and recognize them. The second didn't have a flashlight, so what did he do? He had to teach himself to recognize people's voices. Okay, so which one has the greater clarity? The person who can see, or the person who's recognizing people by their voices? Who has the greater clarity? So the person who can see, right? even if someone is able to train themselves to recognize people by their voices, if you can see as well, so you're going to have greater clarity of the situation. You're going to have an easier time recognizing people. Yet, the second person has an advantage over the first in having developed the new skill of recognizing voices, which the first one hasn't. Right? The first one is not necessarily sharpening any of his senses, whereas the second one, who didn't have the advantage of the flashlight, had to sharpen his skill, had to sharpen his perception, and in order to be able to recognize people by their voice. So what happens? Which one comes out ahead? Right. This is overnight. Now morning comes. Which one is ahead? So the first one, the one who's been using the flashlight, will turn off the flashlight, right? Because it's no use during the day. And the Rehutner says that he'll have gained nothing during the night, which could help him during the day. Right, so he was able to see more clearly because he had the flashlight. But during the day, he didn't necessarily gain anything. But the second one, Umazed, those Hasheni, the second person, he the Akshav Gamu Makir as a Nashim Mikomako Kokos Hashmiya, that the second one, now that he's able to recognize, able to use the new skill of recognizing voices. So that skill will remain with him into the day. So you see that on one hand, the person has more, if you're in a situation where you have more tools or more of an ability to see to recognize more clearly, so that may have an advantage, right? You recognize it more clearly. I didn't scroll down. I apologize. But at the same time, you may not gain as much from your experiences as if you have to try a little bit harder and strengthen certain senses that you have in order to recognize what the person who has more clarity can see, right? So of course, how does this apply to our question of which is more meaningful, important, Hashem's being revealed or being hidden? So it depends. Being revealed has certain advantages, right? It's more apparent that he runs the world. At the same time, when we have to still use our compensate by not being able to see Hashem in the same way, by strengthening our perception of him, we'll take more with us during the harder times. We'll develop a skill of perceiving Hashem that we wouldn't have developed if Hashem was just revealed in the way he was revealed in Pesach and the way he was revealed in the desert. And that was one of the challenges, in fact, that the generation in the desert had, is they were they weren't so sure that they could go into the land of Israel, that they'd be able to work, and they unfortunately failed a lot of tests because they didn't necessarily sharpen this ability to recognize Hashem even when his presence wasn't so apparent. So there's a what about the people who are lazy and won't look? So that's the challenge. That's why it's more difficult. We have to look. We have to use our, if there's darkness, if we can't see, so we have to use our ears. We have to use our other senses. And if we do that, then we'll come out and we'll be able to adapt to different situations, right? The person with the flashlight, it only helped him at night. During the day, he didn't necessarily gain anything. But the person who sharpened their hearing, so they're able to adapt to different situations and able to develop a skill and have an advantage that they wouldn't have had otherwise. I think as Gerald said, and it's definitely true, is when you have to work on Emunah, so your Emunah can become stronger.
But don't we?
Because when Hashem isn't always seem present, we strengthen our perception. That's really what we're meant to gain. And then you have to want to be motivated. Absolutely.
But don't we really, the basis of our religion is that there's no such thing as happenstance. There's nothing is coincidental. There's a reason why everything happens. And it's the master who's behind everything, who's orchestrating everything.
Exactly. But we have to be able to perceive that. You know, we have to be attuned to that. That's true. And that's exactly what Purim is meant to inculcate within us. Is that right? Even when Hashem isn't mentioned, he's still there. And Purim is a time to sharpen that sense of seeing Hashem, even when it's not always apparent. And Rav Meir Simcha of Tvinsk, the Meshech Chachma, says that he explains an idea that the Jewish people accepted more willingly the Torah in the days of Mordechai and Esther. Right? That initially the Mount Sinai was held over our heads. There was a certain amount of, call it, coercion, but then they accepted it with love in the days of Mordechai and Esther. So what was the difference in the initial acceptance at Mount Sinai and the acceptance in the days of Mordechai and Esther? So he says in source number 7 that at Har Sinai, they attained the ultimate level of perception of divine providence, and they acknowledged the truth of Hashem's existence and that the Torah upholds the heavens and the earth, right? They clearly saw that Hashem was there, the importance of the Torah. And they said that they're capable of fulfilling the Torah during a period when we possess the ultimate level of spiritual perception, right? When they were standing at our Sinai, they all accepted it. So what do they essentially agree? They were accepting it with what they knew. They may have been thinking, when Hashem is manifest like this, we will understand the importance of the Torah and we'll follow him. But when the divine presence is concealed within nature, we'll but be unable to abide by the Torah, right? It wasn't clear that generation would be able to abide by the Torah when Hashem wasn't so apparent, which again was a challenge of the Meraglim when they saw they'd have to go into Eretz Yisrael, they have to work with the physical world. So they weren't necessarily prepared for that. But Amna, we may Esther, one of the days of Esther, Kashkocha Haisa is Eretz. That the divine providence was more concealed, Yisrael hayu avdei Achashverosh, and they were servants of Achashverosh, uvachol zos masru nafsham, and nevertheless they were willing to prepare their lives, to give up their lives. They're prepared to give up their lives. Right, Esther went to the king. The people fasted. Mordechai was unwilling to bow to Haman. But have a Kabbalah Shlema. That was a real acceptance of the Torah, right? Because when they accepted it at Har Sinai, they accepted it in the context that it was given, in the context of miracles, and the clear closeness to Hashem, the recognition that He was there. Okay, but we don't know if that would have lasted. And we see, as Paul said, and others say, that you see that in their history, even when they were prophets, it wasn't, once they had to deal with greater challenges, it wasn't so clear that they were up to the task. But in the days of Achashverosh, Mordechai, and Esther, so that's when they demonstrated that they completely accepted the Torah. That was a complete acceptance of the Torah. And that's the acceptance of the Torah that we really live with now, that we don't just serve Hashem and recognize Him and feel compelled to follow Him when there's an Akolos, a Rakim, sounds, lightning. But even when Hashem isn't so revealed, we accept the Torah and we're committed to following the Torah in all situations. So now there's a... another aspect of this, there's a medrash that says that in the future, in the Messianic era, all of the festivals will be nullified. I'm not sure exactly what this means, but it says all of, in source number 8, Shekol Modim Yu Betalin, in the Messianic era, all of the festivals will be nullified. Vimei Purim Lo Yu Nitalin La'olam, but the days of Purim will never be nullified. Shenemar, that these days of Purim will never leave the Jewish people. And their memory will not be lost to its children. Right? This is from Megillas Esther itself. So the Medrash lets in there that Purim will always observe Purim. So why? What aspect does Purim have above other holidays? Right? Why is Purim the only one left? If we take this literally. Moshe, yeah?
It was in the Galut.
Is what?
It was in the Galut. It wasn't in Israel. Something to do with it. I don't know.
Right. So it shows that it can that we can live in exile, right? It's even when we're away from our homeland.
I think the point is to go back to a question that you asked a few minutes ago. The issue is not what is better for us in terms of what does closeness, non-closeness, obviousness. The issue is what does God want? And by that I mean to say is, what sort of bride does God want? What sort of partner does God want? Does God want a partner such as Yetziat Mitzrayim, who has nothing to offer? Or does God want a partner like after the story of Esther, who does more and more on her own and can be seen as having done all of it on her own with God behind them? So
right.
It's not,
I think if you look at the Mishnah Chokhmah, I think it says that there was a Kabbalah Shlema in the times of Mordechai and Esther. It was a more complete acceptance of the Torah because they accepted it even when they told God, as this bride, they told God, we are committed to you, even when, one, we have to be more proactive, and two, you're not always, it's not always as apparent that you're there. And as Debbie said, right, we have to actively seek out God. Absolutely. So one perspective of why maybe Purim is more enduring than even other holidays is found in the Das Tfunos of Moshe Chaim Lutzato, the Ramchal, who explains that in every action that Hashem performs in the world, there are two aspects, right? The revealed and the hidden. And the hidden aspect is the deep design inherent in all of what God does to bring humanity to a general state of perfection, right? There's a plan in everything that's hidden. He says there's no action, great or small, whose inner purpose is not leading to this perfection, right? We only see what we see, but every action has that inner purpose. And the whole point is to lead to the ultimate perfection. So in the future, God will let the Jewish people understand how even the afflictions they underwent were for the good and prepare them for the state of being blessed, right? Eventually, we'll be able to see why things that we couldn't understand, why they occur, because they're all part of Hashem's plan. So in our current time, we don't understand, this. And we see that we can see things in a superficial way, but we have to remember their essence, their true meaning, their true purpose is hidden. But in the times of Mashiach, he said, "Atlasid lavo zeh pagos nira nasig," that in the times of Mashiach, we'll be able to see and understand how these things. We'll be able to see how all of the things that we even saw as difficult, how they contributed to our ultimate benefit in the end. We'll be able to see that in the Messianic era. We don't know that now, but that's really encapsulates Purim, that it's not till the end that we see, right? We see a whole series of random events. The Jews go to the party, then Vashti is deposed, then Mordechai overhears the conversation, well, then Esther is chosen to be the queen, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It wasn't apparent that these just seemed like different random events, not only random events, but negative events. But throughout all of this, Hashem had a plan, and we were given some understanding of what it was. And but Ramchal is saying that's, we have to look we have to look at our lives in that perspective. We have to look at our lives like Purim, that no events that we experience are random. We don't understand that now, but we should at least appreciate there's an inner purpose that we will understand in the days of Mashiach. And there's also an important lesson of the Megillah that not only things that are negative can be turned around, but that even from that which is negative comes the positive. In fact, the negative can be the catalyst for the positive. And this is alluded to in the one of the names for Esther. One of the names for Esther, the Megillah actually says, is Hadassah. So why was she called Hadassah? So what's a Hadassah? Hadassah is a myrtle. So the Gemara says in Megillah in source 10, the Karli Hadassah, the Karli Esther. She's called Hadassah and she's called Esther. So why was she called both? Tani Rabbi Meir, Omer, Esther Shema. Their name was Esther. Velama Nikra Shema Hadassah. So why did they call her name Hadassah? Hashem, that Tzadikim Nikru Hadassim, that the righteous people are called Hadassim. So it reflects a certain righteousness. But I saw a couple of years ago, and I think I've said it on Purim every year since then. It made such an impression on me. And it was from Gedalia Shore. He was the Rosh Yeshiva at Torah Vidas in New York. And he connects the name of Esther as Hadassah to the Haftorah that we read on fast days. The Haftorah from Yeshayahu that says, Tachas anatsus yale v'rosh, that in place of the thorn bush, a cypress shall arise, v'sachas hasir pad yale hadas, and in place of the nettle, a myrtle shall rise. So, Gedalia Shore says that it's not just that, and Hadas alludes to Esther. So he says it's not just that things were turned around, you know, from negative to positive, right? The decree wasn't reversed, but we were allowed to defeat our enemies. Gedalia Shore says it's even further. Tachas anatzis ala barosh, that from the thorn bush a cypress shall rise. Tachas asir bad yala hadas. And in place of the nettle, a myrtle shall arise. Meaning, from, he understands it, specifically, that's the catalyst. The negative is the catalyst for the good. So you have the Jews going to the party of Achashverosh, you have Vashti, you have Esther being taken. But all of that was then the catalyst for the salvation, that Esther was taken. But then she was able to save the people. Right? If you look at all the events in the Megillah, you can see that the negative events were really the catalysts for the positive events. So you see that even mistakes and even things that are negative can be turned into positive things and can actually be catalysts for growth that may not have happened otherwise. And Chaim Friedlander in Sifsei Chaim expands on this idea, and he says that now this can give us an understanding of why in the times of Mashiach, all the holidays will be nullified, except for the days of Purim, which will never be nullified. So he says that the common denominator between the Messianic revelations, the revelations of Purim, is the understanding of how evil served as a means to bring about the revelation of God's unity, that everything develops as God wills it to, despite the appearance of evil, similar to what the Ramchal was saying. This will be the revelation in the future that everyone will understand retroactively how everything was leading to the divine purpose. This is also the revelation of Purim. Within hidden actions, without overstepping the boundaries of natural events, the divine plan was revealed. And when it says that all of the Kol Modim is Batlu, but that all of the holidays will be nullified, why are all the holidays going to be nullified? So, similar discussion is in the Haggadah, the Gemara and Brachos with Yitzias Mitzrayim, that the miracles of the Messianic redemption may eclipse even the great miracles of Yitzias Mitzrayim. So he says that means the future revelations of God will be so much greater than any of the previous ones. Consequently, all the earlier revelations will pale into insignificance, right? Even Yetzias Mitzrayim won't be as great as when Mashiach comes. So what about Purim? The revelation, however, the revelation of Purim is different because it shares the same type of revelation as those of the future, which is the revelations of God, the revelation of God's unity, right? The complete manifestation and of God's presence in the world and the clarity that he's in charge and that he guides our lives. And that's said in the Megillah, Mizichram lo yasuf mizaram, and their memory will not be lost from its children. So you see that Purim, some of us view Purim as maybe lacking that, oh, we don't have the name of Hashem in the Megillah. There's an element of hiddenness, but really that element of hiddenness provides a tremendous opportunity, provides an opportunity to attune ourselves to the presence of God in our lives, to realize that all of our decisions and all of our actions and everything that occurs to us is from Hashem, is from a greater person, is for a greater purpose. And the more we can use Purim, realizing that about the events that happened to Mordechai and Esther, realizing that about the events in our lives, so the more we internalize that, hopefully leading up to Purim and on Purim, the more we can recognize all the events in our lives, big and small, happy and sad, are all from Hashem, from the moments that we consider the biggest ones, to even as Rapinka says, even the cup of water, shakol niyeh bedvaro, that came from Hashem. Really, Purim should attune ourselves to be aware of Hashem's presence, and by being aware of that, hopefully that will give us comfort in difficult situations, knowing that nothing is happenstance, nothing is accidental, and every opportunity, everything that happens to us provides an opportunity. Hopefully, we should use those opportunities, and together, hopefully, just like there were Nisan, there were miracles, there was salvation in the days of Purim, hopefully there will be a salvation this year so great that will even eclipse even the miracles that happened to us before.
Can I just add something that you said was just absolutely beautiful? And I think this may be the one that you said you had heard once and just stuck with you all the time. And I'm sure it's going to stick with me now. I think this Tachas Dvar Torah is mind-blowing. It's just
I'll take the picture. It's from the Or Gedal Yahu. Gedal Yeshua, I'll take a picture of that.
Because I think that the one where Tachas comes up most often is Esther Tachas Vashti.
Right.
And so if you look at that, the whole idea of Vashti beginning Esther, however, whatever that means, it's so Kabbalistic. It's so Hasidish. Like I'd love to know if Rabbi Shore was also a Hasid. But here's the other, other thing. Here's one other small thing. Tachas. What's unusual about that word? It's one of those words that reads backwards and forwards. So it's the perfect word because Vashti Esther, yeah. which way do you read the word? It's mind-blowing. Yeah. It's just mind-blowing. It's like I'm on acid or something. It's just incredible.
Glad I can provide the experience.
Yeah. I should pay for it now. I didn't know you brought samples. All right. See you next week, God willing.
All right. So hopefully next week we'll do another class on Purim, and then leading up to Pesach, we'll hopefully learn some ideas about Pesach and enter the holiday with more understanding and more appreciation.
Shkoyach. Thank you so much. Is mind blowing.